Well, good to be back, and this is an interesting way to end the conference. I had nothing to do with the order of events, in a way, kind of ending on a negative note. The term theonomy, if you don't know, it simply means the law of God. The word theos in Greek means God, and nomos means law. I want to begin by being very clear what I mean by theonomy, because a lot of people use theonomy in a kind of a general or imprecise way, and I think that to fulfill my responsibility here, I need to speak about theonomy in a more precise way. I assume that is what the conference organizers had in mind. So the modern theonomy movement, as I understand it, it refers to the conviction that the civil or judicial laws of the civil or judicial laws of the Old Testament law of Moses ought to be enforced and applied to all political communities today. All right, so now this presumes that we can distinguish different kinds of laws within the Old Testament Mosaic law. So very, very old Christian tradition says that there are three basic kinds of laws within the Mosaic law. By Mosaic law, just to be very clear, I mean the law of Moses that we find in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So this old Christian tradition says that some of these laws are moral laws. And by that, we mean laws that are always, everywhere, binding on all human beings, no matter who they are, where they live, what relationship they have with God. So when the Mosaic law says don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, those are moral laws. And then secondly, there are ceremonial laws in the Old Testament Mosaic law. And these would get at laws about the sacrifices, about the priesthood, laws about ceremonial uncleanness and like the dietary laws. And then third, there are the civil or judicial laws. And these get at Israel's life together as a community, as a political community, laws that were to be enforced by the sword. Right? There were civil penalties. In a number of cases, even death would be the penalty of these laws. Now, just to be very clear, I do think this traditional distinction is helpful. It doesn't mean every single law very, very neatly, every single individual law very neatly fits into one of these categories and only into one of these categories. But that generally speaking, these are kind of three types of laws that we find in the Mosaic law. So back to theonomy. Theonomy teaches that these judicial laws are obligatory for all civil communities at all times, for all civil communities today, and thus that our governmental authorities ought to be enforcing these, applying these to our own community. Now, traditionally, it was held really universally by Christians that these moral laws are still binding. The ceremonial laws are not binding. And so the question is, what do we say about these judicial laws? So theonomy says they ought to be enforced in our civil communities. So that's what the modern theonomy movement says. Now, as a point of clarification, it seems to me that when some people say theonomy, what they really mean is theocracy. And I think it's important to make a distinction between these two terms, even though there's certainly overlap. I would take it that the idea of theocracy means that a certain society that is a theocracy is a holy people. It has a special relationship to God, and it is devoted to a single religion, and the government and its laws ought to support the practice of that one true religion and suppress all other religious ideas and all the people who practice those ideas, suppress them or even eliminate them. I would say that that is theocratic. Now, of course, you don't have to be Christian to be a theocrat. There are Christian versions of theocracy. There are Muslim versions of theocracy, right? If you go to Iran or Saudi Arabia, right? These are examples of theocracies. In a sense, this is a special people, holy to God, some God at least, and all the laws need to be in support of that. Now, I want to make that distinction because someone can be a theocrat without being a theonomist, right? So there are certainly people in the Christian world today who are theocrats, but are not necessarily theonomists. They don't think that all the judicial laws of Moses need to be enforced today. And in fact, the early Reformed theologians, most of the early Protestant theologians, were theocrats of a sort. They did think that civil magistrates had a responsibility to be supporting the one true church and suppressing heresies and blasphemies and the like, but they were not theonomists. I think they were wrong about being theocrats, but it's worth noting that they were not theonomic kinds of theocrats. Now, if you are a theonomist, I think you're by nature a theocrat. I don't know how you could possibly think that you're supposed to be applying the Mosaic judicial laws and not be theocratic in your thinking. I hope that definition, those definitions, helps to clarify what I'm going to say and doesn't confuse you because of these terms, but I'm trying to be as precise as I can. So my plan for this lecture, first I want to offer some historical reflections. Then I would like to offer a number of biblical theological considerations. And then finally, I'd like to offer a couple of concluding thoughts on Christian spirituality and all of my thoughts are against the idea of theonomy, but that last point is why I think theonomy runs afoul of a biblical Christian spirituality. So let me begin with some historical reflections. The modern theonomy movement arose maybe 50 or 60 years ago. So in the big picture of church history, it's a relatively recent movement. But Christian theologians, basically forever, have known that a theonomy-like position is a possible option that Christians might take. And so you can read of Christian theologians through history who have interacted with theonomic kinds of ideas, and they have consistently rejected these ideas. And of course, just because people in the past have rejected idea doesn't mean that it's wrong necessarily, but it is worth knowing that Christian theologians have consistently through history rejected this idea. Now, I want to just say a few things about early Reformed theologians. They often considered theonomy-like ideas. So, for example, John Calvin, in his Institutes of the Christian Religion, he says this, "The Lord did not deliver it," the Old Testament judicial law he's talking about. The Lord did not deliver it by the hand of Moses to be promulgated in all countries and to be everywhere enforced. That is about as clear an anti-theonomy statement as one could possibly make. I don't know how one can make a stronger statement. Or consider a statement from a theologian, and I don't think he's been mentioned, Franciscus Junius, who was really a very important early Reformed theologian, late 16th century. He said this, the holy and wise fathers of the early church taught, quote, that those judicial commandments, talking about the judicial commandments of Moses, are neither absolutely necessary for the state nor apply to it and its function. So notice Junius in the 16th century is saying those godly early church fathers rejected the idea that the Old Testament judicial laws are for every country and ought to be applied to it. He goes on to say, the substance of those things is mutable or changeable in itself. And truly the form of the public laws was established by God according to the mode of those things at that time, not forever. In other words, it was good for God to give these laws to Israel, but they were not meant forever. Now, it's interesting that Junius interacts with a theonomy-like movement in his own day. So he explicitly is interacting with that in this particular work that I'm referring to. And he says this, in these last days, people have emerged with a zeal for piety, truth, and doing righteousness, who contend that it is necessary that their use, talk about the judicial laws, they say it is necessary that their use be reintegrated into the Christian state and that by divine authority we are obligated to observe them. So he's saying, here are these people espousing these theonomy-like ideas. And he goes on to say that this is a zeal without knowledge. He says that these people have a zeal for piety, truth, and doing righteousness, but it's a zeal without knowledge. And one more early Reformed theologian, I want to give these examples. I know it's not the most engaging when someone is speaking and they read a lot of quotes. So I just want to read one more briefly from an early Reformed theologian. This one is Francis Turretin, who was a mid-17th century, prominent, very learned Reformed theologian. And he mentioned a view of the Mosaic judicial laws in his own day that he says wanders from the truth in holding that these laws, quote, are still in force and should be retained, and that Christian states are to be governed like the Jewish. So he rejects that. And he goes on and he says that these judicial laws of Moses accommodated to the genius and reason of the Jewish polity were not only made useless to Christians living under a different polity, but neither can nor ought to be observed any longer. And this is a great, the final part of this quote is really important. He says, the polity having been abolished, the laws must necessarily be abolished upon which that polity was founded. What he's saying there is, if Old Covenant Israel, as God's holy nation, if that has been abolished, then the laws that were given to that polity, those must also be abolished too. And I'll go on and a little bit later reflect on that idea a little bit. I think it's worth noting that this view, which I've been reading some examples, you can find the exact same view espoused by medieval theologians. This is nothing new. I want to make just a brief note to the most famous of medieval theologians, Thomas Aquinas. Now, just to be clear, If you want clear statements of the law-gospel distinction, Thomas Aquinas is not your man for that. All right, and we'll just leave it at that. But Thomas Aquinas was a great theologian in many ways, and he said a lot of things that we Protestants continue to believe. And it's just interesting that he posed the question whether the judicial precepts of the old law bind forever. This is exactly the theonomy question. And his answer is that these judicial precepts were instituted that they might shape the state of that people who were directed to Christ. He's talking about under the old covenant, the people were directed to Christ who was yet to come. And he says, consequently, when the state of that people changed with the coming of Christ, the judicial precepts lost their binding force. So it's really, that statement could have been made by any of those Reformed theologians. And then this view found expression in the Reformed confessions. And Westminster Confession 19:4, chapter 19, section 4, puts it very explicitly. So it's talking about the judicial laws of Moses, and it says, to Israel, as a body politic, God gave sundry judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now further than the general equity thereof may require. So you'll note the main statement is that the judicial laws of Moses expired. And I think it is very safe to say that if a modern-day theonomist was in charge of writing this statement, the main statement would not be the judicial laws have expired, because their view is actually just the opposite of that. The laws have not expired. They continue to oblige. What the Westminster Confession says, that these laws have expired. Now, there is this idea of general equity. If we had more time, I would say more about this. But very briefly, this is an appeal to general principles of justice. In fact, it's related to natural law in my topic last night. There are general natural law principles of justice that all civil communities today ought to be acknowledging. And therefore, there may well be some of our laws today that resemble those judicial laws of Moses, and we shouldn't say, oh no, we have a law against stealing, and we punished thieves, and the Mosaic judicial laws did that, so I guess we shouldn't do that, right? No, there are points of overlap, to be sure, but the point that all of these theologians that I was quoting from a moment ago, what they would all say is, we have laws against theft, not because the Mosaic judicial laws had laws against theft. Right? We have those laws for other reasons, right? As a way to protect our peaceful life together under the natural law. And it shouldn't surprise us that there were similar laws for Israel of old. Now, for my Baptist friends here, I think there are a few of those. The 1689 London Baptist Confession, also chapter 19, section 4, modifies the language of the Westminster Confession a little bit, but it also makes the same main claim, the judicial laws expired. So you find the same basic idea there. So I think if there are any here who are maybe attracted to the modern theonomy movement, or if you're interacting with those who are attracted to this, I think it really is worth knowing that this is not, it's not a historically Reformed position, it's not a historically Christian position, and I wouldn't think we would want to take a view opposed to that lightly, and so it's at least worth some sober reflection. But I want to turn now to biblical theological considerations. So how do we think about the theonomic movement in terms of biblical teaching. And I mean, in many ways, the issues involved here draw on a lot of different texts and a lot of different lines of thought. But it seems to me that, in a way, this is a fairly simple issue, and that there is one main basic reason why theonomy is wrong, biblically speaking. And that main basic reason is that God gave the Mosaic Law as part of the Mosaic Covenant. And thus, when God gave this law to Israel, he designed their judicial laws as the righteous standard for the civil life of Old Covenant Israel, that community that was in covenant with God. And that community was unique in all of history. All right, so the law of Moses was given as part of the Mosaic Covenant, which was a covenant made with one unique nation in all of history. And this Old Covenant community no longer exists. And there is no community in the world today that is like it. And laws perfectly designed for one unique community can't just be taken and placed upon another community. So that is the basic reason. But what I'd like to do is actually break that down now and kind of go through the steps of that basic reason. And I hope to show that theonomy is really not a viable biblical view. So let me begin. The first sub-point of that big main reason that I just gave you. God gave the Mosaic Law as part of the Mosaic Covenant. So if you go back to Exodus 19, just begin there. If you remember, the story of Exodus begins with the Israelites in Egypt, and God leads them out through Moses. And by chapter 19, they finally made it to Mount Sinai. And in chapter 19, God assembles his people at the foot of Mount Sinai, and he declares his covenant with them. So they are a people that, and God makes his covenant with them. He declares them a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They are a holy nation in covenant with God. And at that point, he immediately gives them the Ten Commandments. And following the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 follows the so-called covenant code, which runs from the middle of Exodus 20 through the middle of Exodus 23. All right, these are laws, and actually a lot of judicial laws we find in that covenant code in Exodus 20 through 23. And then in Exodus 24, Moses told the people God's rules. He recorded them and read from what is called the Book of the Covenant. And he threw the blood of the covenant on the people. My point here is that the making of the covenant with Israel at Sinai is inseparable from the giving of that law. Right? It's one story. It's one intertwined story. The making of the covenant, the giving of the law. And, of course, the law's regulations continue in subsequent chapters and books. It's Israel, it's interesting, in Deuteronomy, you find a restatement of the law on the plains of Moab. And this is part of a renewal of the covenant with Israel. Is there a covenant renewal ceremony going on? And what happens when the covenant is renewed? The law is restated. Law and covenant here go together. Okay, so that's the first main point. Mosaic law was given as part of the Mosaic covenant. So then the second point, that Mosaic covenant is no longer in force. The old covenant is no longer in force. The Mosaic law was never intended to be permanent. Right? God gave the Mosaic covenant, and God never wanted this to be the permanent covenant relationship for his people. We know that because, I mean, for one thing, in the book of Deuteronomy, God said to his people, this is actually when he's giving this covenant to the people, he says, you are going to break this covenant. I am going to send you into exile, and you are going to need a new initiative of my grace in order to recover from this tragic event. So, it's kind of interesting to think about this. God makes the covenant, gives the law, and he says to the people, you are not going to keep this law. You ought to, but you are going to break it. And there's going to be a need for this new initiative of my grace. And so what happens, you know, years later, God obviously exercised much forbearance, much mercy to his people, but finally he sent them into exile. Of course, Jeremiah is one of the great prophets living during the time when Israel was being sent off to Babylon. And Jeremiah 31, makes the famous New Covenant prophecy. This is exactly what Deuteronomy indicated. Israel is going to be sent into exile, and what is the solution? The solution is not, well, we're going to keep trying in the Mosaic Covenant. The solution is there's a new covenant. And Jeremiah 31 says it's not going to be like that old covenant. It's not going to be completely different in every way. Certainly not the case, but there are going to be differences. And one of the things he says is that you broke that old covenant. And one of the key differences of the new covenant is not going to be broken. It's going to be a kind of covenant that God's people are not going to break. When Jesus, the promised Messiah, came, the old covenant people, of course, rejected him. And Jesus established this new covenant, that was prophesied by Jeremiah. Jesus established that new covenant in his blood. If you think about the words of the institution of the Lord's Supper, this is the new covenant in my blood. So Jesus established that new covenant. And the book of Hebrews says that it is a better covenant. And Hebrews 8 says that the old covenant has now become obsolete. And that makes sense. I mean, that covenant was broken. Jesus established a new covenant. That old covenant is obsolete. I mean, one of the big points of Hebrews is, why would you want to go back to that old covenant? It couldn't accomplish all the things that Jesus has now accomplished. It pointed to Christ, but it could not accomplish that. So this is that second point. So that my first point, the Mosaic law was given as part of the Mosaic covenant. Second point, the Mosaic covenant is obsolete. It is no longer in force. And that leads to a third point, all kind of expounding that one main idea that I gave you a few minutes ago. So the third sub-point here is that since the old covenant community does not exist any longer, its laws are not binding anywhere. Since the community for which those laws were established no longer exists, the laws are not in force anywhere and ought not to be viewed as in force anywhere. Now, in a way, I just want to appeal here to an idea that is sort of common sense, the kind of things that everyone knows, right? I'm a resident of California. I am now traveling in Nebraska. If I went and did something stupid and got arrested, and I said, well, in California, it's fine to do those things, the answer of the Nebraska authorities would be, who cares? And the same thing would be true vice versa. If you're from Nebraska and you fly to California, you do something stupid, get arrested, and you say, well, Nebraska, we can do those things. Who cares? The laws of Nebraska don't apply in California, and the laws of California don't apply in Nebraska. They're different jurisdictions. Right? You might say they are different political communities. Now, don't get technical on me. Of course, the laws of the U.S. apply in both places, but you know the laws that are distinctive to our different states, they don't apply in the other state. Right? This is just common sense. Right? We all know this. And it's not only the fact that, you know, if you move from one jurisdiction to another, you know, the body of laws you're under changes, but even if you stay in one geographical place and that the state that you are in, the body politic you're in, if that collapses, if that is overturned, then the old laws don't apply anymore. So I'm just trying to think of an example, and I was trying to think of someone who lives on the East Coast in one of the original colonies, and I thought of Mike. I don't think we have too many Massachusetts people here, but let's say Pastor Abendroth goes home and he does something stupid and gets arrested, and he tells the Massachusetts authorities, well, under the 18th century laws of Great Britain, we could do this sort of thing. And it could be that if you were in Massachusetts in the mid-18th century and you were under the laws of Great Britain, maybe that was okay. But what are the Massachusetts authorities going to say? Who cares? Right? Those laws don't apply any longer. Right? You could live in the same geographical place, but you're under a different body politic. And that's the way, remember the Westminster Confession puts it this way. Right? When the body politic changes, if the body politic no longer exists, those laws don't apply any longer. The laws expire. So this leads to the final point of what I described earlier as that main idea of why theonomy is wrong. And that is this, is that the judicial laws of ancient Israel can't apply to any political community today, all the more because political communities today are of a fundamentally different nature than Old Testament Israel as a political community. You can't. No, so I used the example of Nebraska and California earlier. Now, Nebraska and California, in a sense, they're the same kind of thing. They're both states which are part of the United States. All right, so you might say there's a certain plausibility that the same kind of laws would apply there. They don't, but at least when you're comparing Nebraska and California, you're comparing the same kinds of things. What I'm suggesting to you is that all of our political communities today, whether you're thinking about the city of Omaha or the state of Nebraska or the country of the United States or any other country in the world, they are of a fundamentally different nature from Old Covenant Israel. You're not comparing, as they would say, apples and apples. Old Covenant Israel was in special covenant with God. Even a redemptive covenant with God. They were his special holy people. Remember back in Exodus 19. Of all the nations on earth, God said, you, Israel, are a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They were fundamentally different from all the nations of the earth. And God gave them a holy land for this holy people to live in. And this is really important. When God gave these judicial laws, he gave judicial laws that were fit to protect a holy people living in a holy land. And you can see this in a great way. This idea of concern for protecting the holiness of the people and land is crucial in so many of the Mosaic judicial laws. And I think if you ask the question, well, you know, why do the Mosaic judicial laws require, say, the elimination of pagan nations? You remember, as part of the Mosaic judicial law, Israel had to slaughter the pagan nations within the boundaries of their land. Why? Well, that's a big question, but a big part of the answer is this was a holy land to God, and there could not be pagans in this land. There was also a requirement to execute idolaters, blasphemers, Sabbath breakers. You picked up, you know, you pick up sticks on the Sabbath, you're executed. Why? Well, I think a big part of the answer is this is a holy land and a holy people, and there can't be any sorts of defilements of that land. So we ask, is there a holy land now on this earth? Is there a nation that is holy, that lives in a holy land? And the answer is, no, there isn't. Now, if you're thinking really carefully, you might say, well, the church is a holy nation. And the answer is, yes, that is exactly right. There is a holy nation. There is a kingdom of priests. But 1 Peter 2 says that this is the church of Jesus Christ. We are the only holy nation and kingdom of priests in this world. But you know what? God has not given to the church the sword of justice. We have no authority to be punishing criminals. And so we as the church can't be enforcing the judicial laws of Moses. It'd just be wholly inappropriate. And there is no political nation, no political community in this world that is a holy nation. God has not entered into special covenant relationship with any country in this world. And because there is no holy political nation living in a holy land that God has set apart for them, there is no political community that has any business thinking that the Mosaic judicial laws are for them to use to protect their holy land. Now, I would like to talk about this ideally in some more detail. I'm going to have to be very brief about this, but one thing I think is important to say at this point is that biblically, I believe it's true that, in fact, every political community in this world is in covenant with God. The city of Omaha, the state of Nebraska, the United States of America, they're all in covenant with God, but they're in covenant with God through the covenant with Noah that was made after the great flood. This was a universal covenant. This is the covenant that God made with all living creatures. And in this covenant, he didn't distinguish between believers and unbelievers, but he did give the sword of justice to the human community, to all human communities. He who sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Genesis 9, verse 6. So, part of the reason why this is an important point is that if God has entered a covenant with a group of people, that group of people does not have the option of opting out of that covenant and choosing a different covenant that they want to be under, right? I mean, we as the Church of Jesus Christ can't say, well, the new covenant's nice, but I think we would like to be under the Mosaic covenant or covenant of works. If you've been paying attention, you would know that we really wouldn't want to do that. But even if we wanted to do that, we don't have the option. If God is the one who initiates covenants, God establishes covenants, and you can't opt out if you're in it. God has made a covenant with the whole human race in this covenant with Noah after the great flood, enter Genesis 8, Genesis 9. He has given the sword of justice to all human communities, not to protect a holy people in a holy land. There's nothing about that in the Noahic covenant. But The sword of justice is to protect all human beings from unjust violence. And that's what our civil communities are supposed to do. And our civil communities can't say, well, we don't like being under the Noahic covenant. We want to be under the Mosaic covenant and enforce the Mosaic judicial laws. Well, I'm going to wrap up the biblical theological discussion there because we're going to have to close soon. And I want to make 2 points in conclusion about Christian spirituality. I hope that what I've said offers a solid biblical argument for why we ought not to be theonomists. But I think there is a lot more to be said. And I would like to offer these 2 reasons to suggest that given the sort of spirituality that we ought to have as New Covenant Christians, we really can't be theonomists. And the first one is this. There is a certain attitude that we Christians, we New Covenant Christians, ought to have towards unbelievers. I think this is an important point of Christian spirituality. We need to have a certain sort of attitude or posture towards unbelievers. Now, remember, before I talk about that, remember back to the Mosaic Law. What was the Mosaic Law's attitude toward your unbelieving neighbors? Specifically towards the pagan nations who were living in that land. The Mosaic Law trained God's old covenant people to see them as enemies who were to be eliminated. Enemies to be eliminated. I mean, how many times did the Old Testament rebuke God's people for failing to get rid of those pagans by fighting holy war against them? The Mosaic Law taught God's people of old to have a holy war mindset against their unbelieving pagan those unbelieving pagan nations. That is not the attitude that the New Testament tells us as Christians to have. God's law forbids us under the New Covenant to wage holy war. We are not to take up the sword against idolaters, against those who worship false gods or who worship no God at all. As Paul said, our weapons are not the weapons of this world. Paul said in Romans 12:18 that we should live in peace with all people as far as it depends upon us. You see the difference. Striving to live in peace with all people as far as possible is very, very different from waging holy war against your unbelieving pagan neighbors. And I would suggest this. The New Testament teaches us to view our unbelieving neighbors not as enemies to be killed, but as neighbors to be loved and evangelized. I think there's a movement in the Gospel of Matthew that, again, be fun to talk about this in more detail, but if you remember the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, at the end of Matthew 5, Jesus says, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. It is an anti-holy war statement. We are to love and care for all of our neighbors, just as, and that's in Matthew 5, just as God sends rain and sunshine upon the righteous and the unrighteous alike. We are to love all of our neighbors. And that sets the scene for how the Gospel of Matthew ends, which is the Great Commission. Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. I've I've come to like to put it this way. You can't evangelize people that you've killed. If you think that actually, if you think there's some flaw in that statement, you can let me know later. I think it's true. You can't evangelize people you've killed. If you exercise holy war to eliminate pagan idolaters, you can't evangelize them. Christian spirituality says live in peace with all people as far as possible. And one of the great goals of that is that we can hold the gospel out with them, the hope that those who we might view now as enemies would one day be our friends, our spiritual friends in Christ. So that's the first point of Christian spirituality I would like to make. I hope it's obvious why I think trying to apply the Mosaic laws of the Old Testament is inconsistent with that. And then secondly, and finally, that we Christians are sojourners and exiles in this world whose citizenship is in heaven. Right? This is, I think, so fundamental to Christian New Covenant spirituality. Like, our status in this world is those of sojourners and exiles. A sojourner is a person who is wandering away from home, not at home, on the move, temporarily living in a place. An exile is a person who has in some way been put away from his true homeland. 1 Peter 2:11 tells us we are sojourners and we are exiles in this world. Not necessarily because we're living away from our earthly homeland. It may be that you're living in the same place you've lived all your life. But we are all, as Christians, spiritual sojourners. We are all spiritual exiles because, as Philippians 3 says, our citizenship is in heaven. And as Hebrews 13 says, here we have no lasting city, but we are seeking the city to come. And that is essential to Christian spirituality. And if you really embrace that, then this world is always going to be, to some degree, unfamiliar. It is going to be, in some way, you're going to be homesick in this world. If you're not homesick in this world, you're spiritually sick. And I'm afraid that movements like theonomy, I wouldn't say it's only theonomy, but movements like theonomy in part are attempts to make this world more comfortable for us as Christians, to make this world feel more like at home, right? We can get rid of or suppress the people who aren't like us. We can be in charge. We can enact laws that are going to support, you know, the way we look at things. But I think we need to ask, is it our calling from a New Testament perspective to be making this world as familiar and comfortable and homey as possible? Or does the New Testament train us to recognize that there should be a fundamental unfamiliarity for Christians in this world, and that our eyes are set on that kingdom which is to come? We want to see justice done in this world, and we work for that as we can in our own stations, in our own places in this world. But let's be very careful about thinking that it is our primary obligation, or one of our primary obligations, to make this world a home for ourselves in which we feel as comfortable as possible. I'm afraid that's a false promise.